This is Solve It for Kids.
Hello, my most amazing and awesome friends. You are looking wonderful today. Hi, my name is Jed Lee, and this is Solve It for Kids, the podcast that gives kids and families a peek into the real world of scientists, engineers, experts, artists, as they solve problems in their jobs using curiosity, creativity, cooperation, and critical thinking. Right now, please welcome my co-host, the Admiral of Exploration, the Dean of all things STEM and STEAM, Jennifer Swanson!
Hello, Jed. How are you?
I am wonderful. I am reveling in science and nature as Boston has gripped with a cold front and snow in October. Life is wonderful.
Oh, well, it's a little bit warmer down here in Florida, but the thing that we're going to talk about today should get you really interested. We're talking about one of our favorite subjects, the ocean.
Yes, yes, yes. That means we are going to solve a problem that is facing the ocean. What's the problem?
Oh, we'll spin the wheel. Let's find out.
Great idea.
How do we study tiny organisms in an ecosystem as vast as the ocean?
How do you study tiny organisms in an ecosystem as vast as the ocean? Is this another one of these interviews where we're talking about stuff that we can't see that I am not sure even exists?
Yes. Oh, but it does exist. It does exist. So grab your microscope because today our Solve It for Kids expert is Diana Fontaine, a PhD student in biological oceanography, and she studies phytoplankton. Do you know what that is?
No, it sounds like an ingredient in my toothpaste.
It is not. They are tiny bits of algae, but phytoplankton give us almost half of the world's oxygen, and believe it or not, they're food for whales.
Whoa. Wait a minute. Something, whales that are huge, they eat stuff that's like really, really tiny?
Yes, they do. Why don't we welcome Diana to the show? And she can tell us all about it.
Hey, welcome to the show, Almost Dr. Diana.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, we are so excited. So tell us, what are these tiny organisms that we are going to talk about today in the ocean?
So these tiny organisms are called phytoplankton. And essentially, phytoplankton are plants of the sea. So they do photosynthesis, and they take in carbon dioxide and produce oxygen.
Cool. And kind of like, how many are out there? Like, are we talking thousands, millions? Like,
Trillions. There are so many. So in a spoonful of water, you could have thousands of cells. And so they're microscopic. So you can't see a lot of them with your eyes. So you have to look at them under a microscope. But there can be thousands in even just a teaspoon of water.
A teaspoon of water has thousands of creatures inside it?
Yeah, which is pretty crazy.
Wow.
So next time you're at the beach, it's just like you're swimming around with a bunch of little organisms around you.
And that's actually a cool thing. I know people are probably going, ew, no. Science is cool. Because tell us, I'm assuming since there's trillions of them, that these are pretty important little organisms, yes?
Yes, they are super important for the ocean. So because they're plants of the sea, they fuel the entire marine food web. So they get eaten by larger organisms, and then those organisms get eaten by other organisms as well. And so they fuel fisheries and all that, all the important organisms in the ocean that we eat. They also produce over half of the oxygen that humans breathe on Earth. So they're essential for our survival.
Yeah, I'd say that's important.
That sounds real important. But I'm confused. How does something that's in the ocean, under the water, create oxygen for us to breathe above the water?
Yeah, so they take in carbon. So at the air, where the water meets the air, there's interactions between the water and the air. So CO2, carbon dioxide, is absorbed into the water. Phytoplankton take that up through photosynthesis, like plants do on land. And then they produce oxygen, which then ends up getting into the atmosphere through interacting with that air-sea boundary. So it essentially gets out of the ocean that way and then into our atmosphere.
So this happens, like, all the time, every day, day and night. It's going on. It's, these things are eating that carbon dioxide. It's going into the water, and then the oxygen's coming back out?
Yeah, so they need sunlight. So they do it during the day. They need sunlight for the photosynthesis, and then, but it's happening all the time in the ocean. Not often, you don't think about it because it's just happening, but it's a super important process for us to, that's happening on Earth for us.
Wow. Can you name a couple of animals that might eat phytoplankton that kids might know?
There's zooplankton, which are if you think of SpongeBob, that, you know, the plankton, the Mr. Plankton guy in SpongeBob. So that's a type of mesozooplankton. It's a copepod. And then there are also types of microzooplankton. So those are smaller than the mesozooplankton, and that would be like a ciliate or something. And they have a bunch of little the cilia that they eat the phytoplankton with. And then those things get eaten by smaller fish, which then get eaten by bigger fish and the whole food web.
Wow, that's just mind-boggling.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah.
It's very cool. So if you want to study this, I mean, if you can't see this, I'm assuming you can't take, you know, microscopes under the water with you, right?
Right.
So how do you study something that is everywhere in the ocean?
Yeah, so we're really interested in understanding what environmental factors affect phytoplankton. So like nutrients in the water that they need to survive, temperature of the water. And so we go out on a research boat and we collect liters and liters of water. Essentially, I tell my friends that I'm a glorified Brita filter because we're just constantly filtering water. And so what we can do with this recently developed technique is we can collect liters of water and collect the phytoplankton's DNA, which then we can use to look at the types of phytoplankton that are out there.
And there's different types of phytoplankton?
Yes, there are many different types of phytoplankton. So phytoplankton are really, really neat organisms because they have a huge size range. So there can be incredibly small cells, but then they can also be incredibly large. So an analogy that I like to use is, imagine a fish in the city of New York City. That is how big the phytoplankton's, like how big the size range is of those cells.
In the whole city.
Yeah. So imagine if you just dropped a fish. So a fish would be equivalent to the smallest phytoplankton cell, and Manhattan would be equivalent, or New York City would be, be Manhattan, but it would be like the biggest phytoplankton cell. So that's just how big that size range is, which has important ecological consequences as well.
Oh, yeah.
Does it depend on where in the ocean phytoplankton are? Does that determine how big they are?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So it depends on the nutrient availability. So larger phytoplankton cells tend to do better in higher nutrient conditions because of their surface area to volume ratio. So if you look at the poles of the world, there's bigger cells in the Arctic and Antarctic region because there's more nutrients there. And so those cells tend to be bigger. Whereas if you go to the Sargasso Sea where it's an incredibly low nutrient region, there often are smaller cells, unless they have, of course, different adaptations that our lab studies and because they can use nutrients in different ways. But yeah, generally, bigger cells do better in higher nutrient.
So when you're saying nutrients, you're talking food that the phytoplankton can eat and access.
Yeah, so they absorb nutrients. So that would be like nitrate, silicate, phosphate. So these are nutrients that are within the water, and the nutrients come from coastal runoff. They're just dissolved within the ocean.
So why are there more nutrients at the poles?
Because there is more, interactions with, there's more, runoff from land there. Like, so instance, if you were to look at a map, sorry, I'm messing up now. That's if you were to look at a map, you would have higher nutrients along the coastlines. But in polar regions, you have a higher level of nutrients because they're cold. It's colder there, and so I think it's because they're dissolved more. I don't know if
I'm okay.
I don't know how to include that. Sorry.
No, that makes sense. So basically, they have more runoff because that's what happens when you have land and like some of the land erodes and, you know, drops off into the ocean or whatever. So the nutrients are coming from the land and going into the ocean. And then they're being, it's like being dissolved. It's like if you take a powder and you put it into your water and you stir it up, right?
Right.
And then, so the powder would be the nutrients.
Exactly. And it also has to do with ocean currents too, because of the way the ocean currents move around the world. Certain regions, the water's older, so it has less nutrients because the nutrients are being used up as it traverses across the ocean.
Oh, so think of the currents as kind of like the spoon. Stirring your cup of water.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the currents moving around. Wow. You don't think about all this kind of stuff in the ocean, right?
Yeah. And the currents are all, the ocean's all interconnected as well. And so a lot of, it's crazy.
Now, Diana, we hear a lot about, you know, the ocean not being healthy because human beings haven't been taking care of it. Are there any places in the ocean where it's been damaged, so damaged that there are no phytoplankton or there's few phytoplankton?
Yeah, so I don't know, enough about the global distribution of phytoplankton to necessarily answer that question, but I would say that there's going to be winners and losers with climate change. So certain species are going to do better than others. And so it's important to understand what species can handle an increase in temperature or a shift in nutrients and how those species will do under different conditions to understand maybe in 20 years the species composition out in Narragansett Bay is going to be much different than it was 50 years ago. Right. So it's just this balance between what species might do better.
Yeah. So I'm curious. So phytoplankton is very specific. You know, we've had oceanographers on here who study sharks and turtles. So how did you get into phytoplankton? Did you always want to study the ocean from the time you were a kid?
Yeah. So I grew up, being fortunate enough to go to some tide pools. And so we'd always go to tide pools actually in Rhode Island. And I would always explore the tide pools and be like, oh, look at this hermit crab. And then I took a class in high school and it was a marine biology class. And that's where I realized, oh my gosh, I could make a career out of this. And then I went to college and took marine science classes and always focused in on STEM courses. And then I kind of just made my way to study phytoplankton.
That's cool. So when you took the first marine science class, you realized that it's not just the animals and the creatures in the ocean, but there's microscopic tons of things out there.
Yeah. And how important those microscopic organisms are for the function of the entire ocean.
Yeah. I mean, that's crazy because most people don't think about that. Like,
how
do the sharks survive? Well, they have to survive because the food chain along the way can support them.
Right. Exactly.
And it's helping us survive, too, by creating all that oxygen.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
So as you do this, we like to ask our guests, do you run into any problems when you're trying to figure out the phytoplankton? Have you ever had any, you thought you figured something out and then it's wrong? Or I shouldn't say wrong, but you use it in a different way.
Going out to sea is incredibly rewarding, but it comes with challenges. We're living and breathing science days at a time, and it involves working in close quarters. But what I would say is that there have been times where I've sampled, so we have to sample water to look at phytoplankton, and we analyze those samples in a certain way. And there's been times where I've messed up my sampling, where I don't capture the thing that I'm supposed to, but then it results in more data that we can use in a different way to answer more questions. So it's kind of a positive side of that failure because it's you end up getting more things out of it than you would potentially.
One time when I was down in Puerto Rico, we went out on a boat at night and we were shown some glowing phytoplankton. That was really wild. And I didn't have the sense to ask the folks why that was happening.
Yeah, so those I those are beautiful. So those are a certain type of phytoplankton called dinoflagellates. And those actually get their food from the sun. They can get their food from the sun, but they can also eat other things. So they have this dual type of food acquiring. But they, that's called bioluminescence. And they have in their actual cell, they release this light when they're disturbed. So if you notice that, like, if you put your hand in the water, it would particularly happen, that light, because they're being disturbed. And so as they're experiencing that disturbance, or like a wave crashing, they emit that light. And that's what you see is the bioluminescence.
Wow. Yeah, that was really, really wild. So cool.
What color was it? I'm curious. Was it like yellow or?
As I remember, it was like kind of like yellow, kind of like a firefly color.
Yeah.
Okay.
I've actually seen it. So we have to filter, like I said, we have to filter onto these little filter pads. They're white. And we filter in the dark because phytoplankton have chlorophyll, which helps them do photosynthesis. And so we could see as the water was getting down onto the filter, it would like spark a quick light. And so we could actually see it while we were filtering. It was so cool.
Oh, that is cool. See, and you know, I just am so amazed that these tiny, tiny organisms are everywhere. Now, do you only see the bioluminescent ones in certain areas, I assume?
Yeah, certain regions. And it depends on which species are there. So you'd only see it. And there's a lot of them in bays in Puerto Rico.
Yeah. Now, is phytoplankton only found in oceans, or do we also find them in freshwater too?
You can also find them in freshwater. One of my lab mates actually came from a freshwater lab. So he was looking at phytoplankton in rivers. And actually you can get certain types of phytoplankton called diatoms. They can survive. They survive on rock surfaces. So he would actually go out and scrape the diatoms off the rocks and then look at them under the microscope.
Wow.
I did not know that phytoplankton lived on rocks.
Yeah,
wow.
So they come in like all different types and thousands of different species.
Wow. So do they pull how do they do photosynthesis just from the sunlight? They just pull the carbon dioxide out of the air then, or?
So they're still they're in a river system. So they're still
Okay.
Water.
Okay.
Yep. Yep.
Okay. So they're still wet and they're still having water. Okay. Yep.
This might sound like a silly question, but when you finally find the phytoplankton and you're able to look at them underneath the microscopes, what do they look like? They're like the cute little creatures or what?
They're really cool looking. Yeah, they're so some of them have these crazy spines. Some of them are perfectly circular. Those are called Coscinodiscus. That's a diatom. And they're beautiful. I highly recommend all of you at home to look up some pictures of phytoplankton because they come in all ranges of sizes and shapes.
So if kids wanted to capture them and look at them, I mean, what kind of microscope would they be able to see it with just a regular microscope, or do you have to have some kind of special microscope to see phytoplankton?
You could see the bigger ones with a regular, a simple regular microscope.
With like a 300 power or 150 something?
Yeah, and you could see, we actually saw the big ones that I've said, the Coscinodiscus ones, we have seen those with our eyes because they're so big. So wow. We were out on the North Atlantic in the wintertime, and some of the cells were getting caught up in one of our nets, and there were just thousands of these beautiful circular cells. And we could see them like sprinkled over our filters, kind of like they're the size of the tip of a needle, but you could see them with your eye.
Wow. So like almost like a salt shaker is what I'm imagining.
Yes. Like little grains of pepper. Yeah.
Wow. That's amazing. Now that's certainly a great challenge that kids who have microscopes can do. But I'm wondering, we love to make the show totally interactive. Is there another challenge that the kids could do that kind of help them better understand what phytoplankton is all about?
Yeah. So I have one idea. So as we go out and collect these liters and liters of water, we're collecting their phytoplankton's DNA to look at what phytoplankton are present in the ocean. You can actually extract DNA from strawberries, and you can use household objects. So you just need a strawberry and you need rubbing alcohol, some soap, and you can follow a procedure online to extract the DNA in a little tube, and then you can see, you could actually see the DNA in the tube.
Oh, I have to do that. That sounds so cool. I didn't know you could do that.
Yeah, so then you could see, you could get a visual for what we're actually collecting out in the field.
Awesome. And we should just stick with strawberries. We shouldn't try to get the DNA off our little brothers and sisters.
No.
No.
Okay.
No. But that is a great challenge. So any of you out there listening, if you want to do Diana's challenge, first of all, go to our website, solveitforkids.com, because we'll have it there and we'll have a link to the experiment. So you'll have all the steps that you know what to do. And then take a picture of us and tag us on our social media, which is on Twitter and Instagram. We're at KidsSolve. And we'll also tag Diana, and she can take a look at some of your cool DNA.
Yeah.
Strawberries. Or you can also, if you want to, take pictures of the phytoplankton that you capture if you get some. Because I have a microscope, and I live 4 miles from the ocean. I might just be going and getting some samples this weekend.
Yeah. Cool. Yeah. And you can also practice drawing phytoplankton. You can look up pictures of phytoplankton, and they're really fun to draw if any of you want to explore the artistic side.
Wow. Three absolutely amazing challenges this week. This is awesome.
Yes. It's been tons of fun. So, again, everybody, make sure you go check out our website, solveitforkids.com. There'll be tons of more information about Diana. Maybe we'll get to see some pictures of her in action collecting things. And we'll also put up some pictures of phytoplankton so you can see what they look like.
Yeah.
And not just have to imagine them in your head. But I think this was fabulous. Don't you think, Jen?
Absolutely, Diane. Thanks so much for being on Solve It for Kids.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Wow, Jennifer, that was amazing. I learned so much today.
Right, and I mean, think about this whole world in the ocean that we all know, the fish, the octopus, all that kind of stuff, but there's a whole world we can't even see. Isn't that just incredible? Science is awesome.
It really is awesome, and it's so exciting that there's so much to learn. There's so many different things to discover out there, and kids that are listening to this show today are going to be discovering that stuff in the future.
Absolutely. And for those of you kids that want to be inspired by Diana and all the rest of our guests, be sure to check out our website, solveitforkids.com. We have an information and pictures of Diana out in the field in the ocean. We have her challenge listed there. And also, if you go on the teacher tab, we now have 3 episodes that you teachers can use in your classroom.
That's wonderful. And that's the neat thing. I mean, teachers could use any podcast out there, but you've created these great activities and teacher guides. So they don't even have to do anything. It's just download it and go to work.
Right. And now we have 3. So we have one about how do you map an underwater forest? We have an engineering one about how do you move water from one place to the other. And for anybody who's interested in music, we have a new teacher pack with award-winning conductor and composer Eric Whitaker about how do you compose music that is as big as the universe. So check them out at solveitforkids.com.
Yeah. Jennifer, I can't wait till our next episode of
Solve It for Kids.